Okay. Good. Today we'll be discussing Bezrat Hashem, the Salvatic dynasty. From the we'll start from the Gra down to our own day, with some stories about the different Rabbanim along the way as well. In front of you have the two sheets that gives you a basic background of the genealogy. This comes from Rabbi Kepitz's book on Rav Soloveitchik. All right, just to give you some background. So the Vilna Gaon is considered one of the greatest Achronim of the last 500 years. He lived 1720 to 1797. We discussed him in a different shir, Parshas Vayigash, and he's considered the father of the non-Hasidish Torah world, his approach. And okay, that's the Vilna Gaon. He was a super giant beyond belief, like a whole different world. His greatest Talmud was Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Chaim Volozhiner is considered the greatest, it's on the sheet here in front of you, the greatest Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, he did a lot of things. He was known. He eventually opened up the yeshiva of Volozhin, which we'll get to Bezrat Hashem in a few minutes. And he also wrote the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim. The Sefer Nefesh HaChaim is considered the classic work in the Torah world about the centrality of Lima Torah and everything revolves around Lima Torah and what Lima Torah accomplishes up in Shemayim. Just some stories about Rav Chaim Volozhiner. It's recorded in the books. Rav Chaim's son or somebody records how Rav Chaim felt when he came to Vilna to visit the Gra. As he get close to Vilna, he'd start like trembling and shaking and getting nervous, because when Rav Chaim went to see the Gra, he was in such awe of the Gra that this rabbi heard use it as like a mushel for, you know, what does it mean, you know, Yiras Haromus, when you have fear of Hashem, you're afraid of Hashem punishing you. You're in awe of Hashem. You're supposed to be in awe of fear, because you're in the presence of the ultimate greatness. So the Havda, we think about it. If you're in front of President Bush, I have a hard time saying President Obama. So you're in front of President Bush. It's a joke. It's fine. You're in front of President Bush. So you act a certain way, not because your fate will punish you, just because, like, you're in front of the president. So the Havdil, they describe, like, he would, like, physically, like, shake and, like, have tremors when he'd go see the Gra. See, when you were the Gra's Talmud, it doesn't mean you learned by the Gra. He didn't give a shiur. You learned your own thing, and you came and talked and learning with the Gra once in a while. So I think it's a good mashal. What it means, the fear, like, that's a buster for dumb, and just to be in the presence of greatness. That's Rav Chaim Volozhiner. After the Gra died, in the early 1800s, he opened the Yeshiva of Volozhin. Yeshiva of Volozhin is considered the mother of all the modern-day yeshivas. Until that time, you didn't have big yeshivas like Volozhin. You learned in your town, and then different rabbanim in towns had boys learn around them. If you were very chashiv rav, you had a small group that came to your town to learn by you, and you had a rabbi. The idea of a central yeshiva with a lot of the great minds all together, with all the great boys all together in a central yeshiva, was a new idea. He opened Volozhin after the Gra died, but the Masorah is he went to discuss it with the Gra when the Gra was still alive. And Rabbi Simon told this great story. This is in the Svarim, that the first time he came to the Gra to discuss opening the yeshiva with him, the Gra ignored him. He said, "Is it a good idea? I want to open the yeshiva. Is it a good idea?" The Gra ignored him. Didn't respond. Like, he just, you know. He came back again a couple of weeks later, and the Gra said, "Yes, you should do it." So he asked him, "Why did you? How come the first time you didn't respond?" So the Gra said, and Rav Simon used it as a musarvort to teach you the idea that your beginnings have to be pure. That the Gra said, when you came the first time, I sensed like an ounce of your own initiative, like your own, I want to open the yeshiva. And it was 99.9% L'shem Shemayim, and a drop that you had like your own personal things inside. And I wanted to get rid of that. That when you come to open the yeshiva, you're opening the yeshiva 100% L'shem Shemayim, to spread Torah. So I ignored you the first time to break that little piece of, it's my own thing, like my own, you know, it's my accomplishment. It's all in L'shem Shemayim. And it's an amazing story, because Volozhin Taka became the greatest yeshiva for 100 years. That's a prime Volozhiner. And again, this year should be 6 hours long. I can't speak 6 hours, but theoretically, you know, each person. Now, the Briskers claim that they go back to the Grah because they go back to through applying Velazhin. And they do go back through applying Velazhin. And this is, it's on the sheet in front of you. It's fascinating. If you want to talk about, you know, genius genes, if you look at what happens here with Reb Chaim and his wife and Reb Chaim's children. So we'll just go through this once, then we're going to go back and discuss the Beis HaLevi separately. So the Soloveitchiks are linked up to Reb Chaim Volozhiner in two parallel ways, one through his daughter and one through his son. It's fascinating. Reb Chaim Volozhiner's daughter, it's the first sheet in front of you, married Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. Okay, so that's his son-in-law. That's where the Soloveitchik name comes from, son-in-law. Soloveitchik means sparrow, I think, in Yiddish, or whatever language it comes from. And sparrow means to sing, and the Soloveitchiks are Levim, and the Levim sing in the Beis HaMikdash. So that's where the name comes from. Okay. Now, then Rav Yosef's son is Rav Yitzchak Zev. That's the grandson of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Yitzchak Zev's son is Rav Yosef Be'er Soloveitchik. That's the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi we'll be discussing soon. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's great-grandfather. So the Beis HaLevi is a great-grandson directly of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. His son is Reb Chaim, so the famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is a great-great-grandson of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Okay, that's interesting. Now, on the other side, this is also interesting, the next page, Reb Chaim Volozhiner had a son, Rav Yitzchak Volozhiner. He took over the yeshiva part of the time after Reb Chaim died. He had a daughter, his granddaughter, who married the Netziv. The Netziv should be here, actually. Mistake. Married the Netziv. So Reb Chaim Volozhiner's granddaughter married the Netziv. And then, the Netziv's granddaughter married Reb Chaim, which means that Reb Chaim's wife was a direct great-great-granddaughter from Reb Chaim Volozhiner. So you have a great-great-grandson and a great-great-granddaughter marrying each other. Talk about the genes in the family. So Reb Chaim's kids were coming through Reb Chaim Volozhiner from two different sides and meeting. That I found that very... I didn't know that until I looked at the book carefully. That's very interesting. Okay, so that's how it goes back to Reb Chaim Volozhiner and back to the Grah. That's what the Briskers say, that they come from the Grah. That's what the Soloveitchiks say. All right. Here we go. Let's go one at a time. We'll start with the Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi is Rabbi Soloveitchik's great... This is the rub's going to be here. Rabbi Soloveitchik's great-grandfather is the Beis HaLevi. He's the great-grandson of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. The Beis HaLevi was a super giant. He was Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhiner in the mid-1800s. He actually, for a while, was co-Rosh Yeshiva with the Netziv. Then there was a whole to-do in Volozhiner, and because it wasn't working out through Rosh Yeshiva, and there was a whole Din Torah, and the Beis HaLevi left Volozhiner, and eventually ended up as the Rav of the city of Brisk. And that's where the connection between the Soloveitchik and Brisk comes from, that the Beis HaLevi became the Rav in Brisk. The way I understand it was a few years after he left Volozhiner, is when he became the Rav in Brisk. The Beis HaLevi was, like I said, a super giant. He's he wrote his tshuvas, three volumes of his tshuvas, and he has the Beis HaLevi on Chumash. If you look in the Beis HaLevi on Chumash, so there's a short section after Bereishis and a short section after Shmos. One's about the laws of Chanukah, and one's about the laws of Tzolin and Mezuzah. And they're considered classic works in Lumdis. We're discussing now the Beis HaLevi. Classic works in Lumdis on those topics. And the story goes, he wrote those are like lighter topics. When he wasn't feeling well, he worked on those topics. The doctor said, you can't tax yourself too much, so write something lighter. So his light writing on Chanukah and Tefillin Mezuzah are when you learn those topics, Be'iyun, the classic works everyone uses. It's printed in the back of the Brashin Smos and the Beis HaLevi. That's the Beis HaLevi. Okay. The Beis HaLevi was known to be very sharp. And there is a great story about him. There's a book called My Uncle the Netziv. We'll get to this later. My Uncle the Netziv was written by the Torah Tmima about his uncle, the Netziv. And one night, the Torah Tmima spent an evening in the same room with the Beis HaLevi in an inn. And he describes the following incident, and this captures who the Beis Halevi was with his sharp, sharpness. He had a student who was visiting the hotel room to schmooze with him, and the Beis Halevi was a little annoyed that this student had left learning to go open a business. He felt he had a lot of potential in learning. So the Beis Halevi said to him, "Basmachtu, how are you doing?" And the guy said, "I'm doing well, Rabbi Baruch Hashem. I opened a store with a friend of mine." Basically, they ignored his answer and talked to the rest of the crowd. 10 minutes later, again, "Vosmachtu, how are you doing?" He thought he wanted more details. He says, "Well, we're expanding and this," and he gave him more what he's doing with his business. He's doing well, Baruch Hashem, and giving, well, that's what he said. Basically, they ignored him again. 10 minutes later, "Vosmachtu, how are you doing?" And the guy said to him, "Rabbi, I don't get it. I explained to you twice already. You know, what's going on over here?" So basically, we said to him as follows. The Gemara says, "Hakol bidei shemayim." It's all, everything's from shemayim. Whether you're healthy, whether you're wealthy, invest in the right stock, the wrong stock, it's all coming from Hashem. All those things are governed by Hashem. There's one thing that you are in control of. Hakol bidei shemayim chutz mi yirah shemayim. Yirah shemayim means, are you learning? Are you davening well? Are you doing chesed? Are you giving tzedakah? That's what you're doing. And that's up to you. Hakol bidei shemayim chutz mi yirah shemayim. So when I asked you, how are you doing, and you're talking about your business, I saw you misunderstood my question, and you didn't get it. Now, the third time, you didn't get it. All right, so now I have to explain to you. If I asked you how you're doing, I want to hear, are you creating with Torah? Are you davening, giving tzedakah, etc., chesed? If I wanted to know about your business, I would have asked you, how is Hashem doing by you today? And then you talk about your business. That's the way the Beis Halevi spoke, and that's the Beis Halevi. He died in 1892 as the Rav of Brisk, and you'll see it sort of worked out that soon after he died, Volozhin closed, or right before he died, around then, and Rav Chaim, his son, went and took over in Brisk. So that's the Beis Halevi, Rosh Yiva and Volozhin, super giants. He's considered really the father of the Soloveitchik dynasty, the Beis Halevi. It's called the Beis Halevi, the Levi, and he has Tshuva's Shoot Beis Halevi. Normally it's in like a pinkish cover. It's good for the shelf. You want to have like add a little cuddle color to your Sfarim shelves. The Beis Halevi Sfarim are good for that as well. That is the Beis Halevi. Okay. Now, the Reb Chaim's wife's grandfather was the Netziv. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berliner. It's on your sheet in front of you. Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berliner. He's called the Netziv. You have the years there, 1816 to 1893. The Netziv was Rosh Yiv with the Beis Halevi in Volozhin, and then the Beis Halevi left, and he was the main Rosh Yiv in Volozhin. The last 30 years of Volozhin, 35 years, he was Rosh Yiv of maybe 40 years. Rosh Yiv of Volozhin, that's what he's known for. Volozhin was the greatest yeshiva. All the leading Rabbanim Kimat of the next generation learned in Volozhin, and that is the Netziv. That's the Netziv. Okay. The Netziv is known, it's in the history books, as a young child, he wasn't like a genius as a young child. Oh, when he's 8 years old, he knows Shas by heart. And the books talk about the Netziv just put the work in. Got married, we'll get this, at a very young age. And after he got married, just sat and learned for years and years and years and became a super giant. He's used as the example of someone who wasn't known as a child prodigy. He's a genius when he's 12, when he's 10 or 9, and he became a super giant by the tremendous hard work. That is the, let's see, if there's a great book out there written by his nephew, the Torah Tmimo, we'll get to that in a minute, called My Uncle the Netziv. It's a great book, gives you a picture of what the Netziv was like, how he dealt with people, and running Volozhin. The Netziv has something interesting. The Netziv was married twice, and we'll discuss that in a minute. And this being married twice is the secret for something completely about the Netziv's life. The Netziv had two sons who were born 48 years apart. Look here on the sheet. Look here on the second sheet. The Netziv is the father of Reb Chaim Berlin. Reb Chaim Berlin, that's the yeshiva of Chaim Berlin in America, is named after Reb Chaim Berlin. Reb Chaim Berlin is born 1832 to 1912. Look on the right side of the page. The Netziach had another son, Rav Meir Berlin. He came to Israel, helped start Bar Ilan, changed his name to Bar Ilan, Rav Meir Bar Ilan, 1948-1949. So Rav Meir Berlin was born 48 years after his older brother. That's like a grandfather. That's amazing. How did that work? Because the Netziach had two wives. And when his first wife died, so when he married his second wife, she was much younger, and much younger, and she wanted to have children with the Netziach. So the Netziach, his first child was born when he was 16. He got married very young, very young. I think he got married at 14 or 15. His first son's born when he's 16, and his next son's born when he was 64. So he has two kids 48 years apart. That's like a riddle in modern Torah history that you can have such a thing. But that's a Netziach. Okay, fabulous. Okay. So what's the story? So the Netziach's married, and he has a son, Reb Chaim Berlin. Then the Netziach's first wife died. Now, who was the Netziach's second wife? The Netziach's second wife, it says Bat Yamiril, that was her second marriage. Her first marriage, she married a guy, and it turns out he was a faker. She wanted to marry someone who was into learning, but he wasn't into learning, this Bat Yamiril's first husband. And she ran away from her husband. And she ran away, and she was living in the forest, and it was illegal to live in the forest, and the police were chasing her, and she was running away. How do we know this? Because her son, Rav Meir Berlin, wrote a little biography about her, which I don't read, but Rav Schechter read everything. So Rav Schechter tells a story over from the book about talking about his mother. So she ran away from her husband because she wanted to marry someone who was into learning. She stayed in Israel for 3 years. Talk about being brainwashed. Okay. There you go. So So finally she gets a get from her husband. She's a young divorcee. She hears the Netziach's first wife died, and they made a shidduch between the Netziach and Bat Yamiril. Now, she was his niece. If you look carefully, the Netziach's first wife, Reina Batya, was the sister of the No, the, no, I'm sorry. The Netziach's sister married Yoruch HaShulchan. Right. The Netziach's sister married the Yoruch HaShulchan. Okay, you see the Yoruch HaShulchan? So this girl, Bat Yamiril, this young woman, was the Netziach's niece. So the Netziach married his niece. You ought to marry your niece. You ought to do that. Okay. That's his second wife. She was much younger than the Netziach, had a lot of energy and everything, so she took over the house totally. So for 30 years, whatever, many years, she helped. She was involved in running the house that left the Netziach free to run the yeshiva of the Lajin. So you look there. Rav Yoruch HaShulchan is Rav Yechiel Epstein. His son was the Torah Tamima, Rav Baruch Epstein. So the Torah Tamima was the Netziach's nephew, because the Torah Tamima's mother was the Netziach's sister. That's why he wrote a book called My Uncle, the Netziach. Well, I'll get that in a second. What? Oh, but later became his brother-in-law. So therefore, the official title of that book should be My Uncle and Brother-in-Law, the Netziach. If you want to be precise, he was the Netziach's brother-in-law as well later. Fascinating story. It's a quirk of Torah history that the Torah Tamima was the Netziach's uncle, was the Netziach's nephew, and later became his brother-in-law. Fascinating. You got the case? Because you're allowed to marry your niece. So he married his niece. So therefore, the niece's brother became his brother-in-law. The Torah Tamima didn't write a book called Melchizedek. The Torah Tamima wrote a book called the Makor Baruch. It's a fascinating book. A lot of pages. People who read all these books read that book as well. It's historical vignettes and biographies about the different Gedolim. So one little piece of that book is about the Netziach, because the Torah Tamima learned in Volozhin when the Netziach was Rosh Yeshiva. So he was there on the inside. He was his nephew. He wrote a lot of... So Art Scroll took one piece of Makor Baruch and translated it into English, called Melko the Netziach. You with me? So that's the Netziach. The Netziach ran Volozhin, a supergiant, and his granddaughter married Reb Chaim. His granddaughter married Reb Chaim. Okay. Volozhin was closed in 1892. In around 1881, Reb Chaim was appointed as a Magid Shir in Volozhin. We'll get to Reb Chaim in 1 minute. We're going to focus on Reb Chaim. in Volozhin, he was married to the Nitziv's granddaughter. And Reb Chaim had a different style of learning and this, and it's a fascinating story. When Reb Chaim took over Volozhin, it was a new, different style of learning, and people were nervous. It's the big, best, most important yeshiva in the world, and Reb Chaim is like giving a different style of shir, and maybe he shouldn't be the top magid shir in Volozhin. So they actually brought in three great rabbanim to hear Reb Chaim give shir, and they're going to be testing whether he should be the one who's the top magid shir in Volozhin. Listen, Volozhin was the greatest yeshiva, so being the top magid shir meant like you're the top in the Torah world. You have to be. So Reb Chaim is giving the shir, or some sort of shir in Yevamos, and the story goes he was giving a shir, and in the middle of the shir, it was about the Rambam. He thought of a Rambam in the Parish HaMishnayos somewhere else, which what he was developing about the Rambam in Yevamos is contradicted by that Rambam over there in Parish HaMishnayos. So during this test, so Reb Chaim in the middle of the shir sat down and said, what I'm saying is wrong, and he sat down. And he stopped giving this. This is the test year. This is like you're coming to a yeshiva, your test year, you're coming to a shul, you're giving your sermon to see if you're going to be the rabbi of the shul. Middle of the sermon, everything I said is wrong, and he sits down. That's Reb Chaim. All right. So, of course, the happy ending is that the rabbanim said, they asked him afterwards. See, they didn't know about the Rambam in Parish HaMishnayos. So they said, anyone who's so intellectually honest to let himself be embarrassed in the middle of his test year and sit down, I made a mistake, I'm wrong, he's into the MS, that's what he wants. He should be the Magid Shir in Volozhin, and he kept the job. See, part of the story was he married the Nitziv's granddaughter, so they're saying, oh, the Nitziv's granddaughter, maybe that's why he's with Magid Shir. We have to see if he's going to be, if he really belongs. So that was the famous story. So that's the Beis Halevi. That's the Nitziv. There's much, much more to say about this, of course, but okay. That's the Beis Halevi, and that's the Nitziv. Reb Chaim is the Beis Halevi's son. That's the famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. He's the one who started what's called the Brisker Derech, this Derech HaLimud. The Brisker Derech has basically taken over the non-Hasidish, non-Sephardi learning world. That's just the way it is. The Brisker Derech, that everyone's learning more or less in one degree or another. People are learning with the Brisker Derech. What's the Brisker Derech all about? It's about precision of language. It's about definitions. Having precise, you know, if you look carefully, if you listen carefully, you hear a real brisker give a shir, they don't use the word like and sort of. And there's a precision of language, a precision of thought, classifying things exactly the way they're supposed to be. And this Reb Chaim developed. Reb Chaim developed. Like there's a story they say that when you ask a brisker a question, he'll explain to you. Not that, oh, good question, but here's the answer. I'll quote another source to give an answer. He'll explain that if you understood the roots of the halacha properly, then your question falls away. So they tell a joke that people say, if you ask a big rabbi a question, he says, good question, here's the answer. If you ask a prime a question, so therefore the guy who asked the question is happy, good question. The rabbi gave an answer, he solved the problem. With Reb Chaim, the joke was, the one who asked the question wasn't happy afterwards, and Reb Chaim wasn't so happy afterwards. What happened? You asked Reb Chaim a question. He'd explain to you, if you understood properly the original sources, the question falls away. Meaning, your question was a good question because it wasn't built in anything correct. And the answer is obvious because once you understand the Yesodos, the answer is obvious. So the question wasn't a question and the answer is obvious. That's Reb Chaim. It's a certain approach to learning, the precision of language. If you hear real briskers give shiurim, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is one of his sons of Eliyahu Soloveitchik, Rebbe in Landers now. He gave some shiurim here. He's a brisker. He gives a shiur, the way he talks. He also has a certain chayin about him, but he talks precise language. Was it this year or last year? Last year. He's giving a shiur. I asked two questions during this year, and both times he says, just what I explained now, but I was happy because I like to see a brisker in action. He said, no. But I explained that the Rambam's Yesod was this, and if that's the Yesod, then what you're asking is not a question. Mamash, what I just spoke about now was fabulous. Rav Eliyahu Soloveitchik gives tremendous shiurim. He's a very pleasant person. As I met him in the Keli Mikvah in Kew Garden Hills when I was in the States for Pesach. You with me?
This year.
And I mentioned that I was working on a Gra on Shulchan Aruch about Yachatz. You know we do yachatz, we bake the middle matzah. Why do we do yachatz? Why is the matzah broken in half? Why is the matzah broken in half? What does the Torah say? What? Lechem oni. Poor man's bread. Broken piece of matzah. You have to do the mitzvah with a broken piece of matzah. Okay? So you have half a piece of matzah. And then you put away the other half for the afikoman later. You hide it, you put it away for the afikoman later. Why do you put it away for the afikoman later? So the Gra says, you know why? Because that's also a mitzvah of eating matzah, the afikoman. And you want that mitzvah to also be what type of piece? Dafka what? A broken piece. So you break it in half. Half for the first, half for two broken pieces. That's a deep idea, the Gra is saying. It's not stam, the leftovers go there. It's dafka, a broken piece. You with me? So I mentioned this to him in the Keli Mikvah. And he said, yeah, he knew the Gra. He said, yeah. He said, you know, it's a nafkamina. He says, great. What's a nafkamina? Let's say there isn't enough matzah. Normally the afikoman comes back like, you know, flour, right? That's all smashed by everyone smashing it, right? The afikoman, right? The matzah meal. Are you with me? The afikoman comes back. It's not really, okay, and it's not enough. So what do you, so you take other matzah to eat the afikoman. So he said, nafkamina, according to the Gra, if you take another piece of matzah, you shouldn't take a whole piece and bite into it. If you should take whatever, you should break it in half and eat it like that. Now most of us don't like take a huge hand matzah and start chopping away on the outsides anyway. But isn't that fabulous? Right there in the Keli Mikvah, that's a great halachu maisa nafkamina that he thought about on the spot. I mentioned Rav Lando later, and he liked it a lot. All right, anyway. That's Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim was, they say in the books, he was such a thinker. They say it in the books when he was thinking, his head was hot. That's what they say. Like you see, like, you know, he's on fire. This is like he was so absorbed in his thought and his learning, the way of thought. Okay. The books talk about the following stories. You know, Sherlock Holmes? Sherlock Holmes, like, you know, deductive reasoning. Yeah? So, like, if Sherlock Holmes saw, like, the way you're dressed, oh, well, if he's carrying, like, he'd say, oh, he would know exactly what the guy's doing. Like, if a guy's carrying an umbrella and it's a sunny day, oh, he's on his way to the train to go to a city where there's bad weather, and that's why he's carrying an umbrella. You understand? That you read Sherlock Holmes, that's what goes on in the books. And so that's how you figure everything out. Okay. So Rav Chaim could do that, and he could see someone for 2 seconds and know where he's going, where he's heading. That's Rav Chaim. All right. So the story goes, it's in the books, that once Rav Chaim looked out the window, and he was troubled by something. And they said, what's bothering you? He said, that guy, I can't figure out what he's doing. He's like, why? You can't figure out what he's doing. So they all ran outside to ask the guy, what are you doing? What are you doing? So the guy says, I don't know. I'm totally lost. I don't know where I'm going. That's a fabulous, you with me? That's a fabulous story. So that's how he said, no, where's he going? So that's Rav Chaim, that way of thinking, the power of thought, that's Rav Chaim. All right. Rav Chaim became the Rav of Brisk. Volozhin closed 1892. That's around when the Beis Halevi died. Rav Chaim leaves Brisk, leaves Volozhin, and goes to Brisk to take over for his father. So after Rav Chaim finished in Volozhin, he went to Brisk. Now, in those 11, 12 years in Volozhin, Rav Chaim taught a whole generation of the next generation of the great Magidei Shiurim. Rav Baruch Berlibowitz, the Birkas Shmuel, learned under Rav Chaim and Volozhin. Rav Zal Meltzer learned under Rav Chaim and Volozhin, the Eben HaEzel. Rav Shimon Shkup learned under Rav Chaim and Volozhin. Everyone learned under Rav Chaim and Volozhin. So Rav Chaim's derech spread through his Talmidim in Volozhin in that 12-year period before it closed. They grabbed his derech and spread it further. There's a story in the books. Rav Shimon Shkup was like this. Rav Chaim's style was different than the Netziv style. The Netziv was more the old-fashioned style, and Rav Chaim was the new style. Not everyone liked it in the beginning. So some guys liked the Netziv style, some guys liked Rav Chaim's style. So they would take turns giving shir. So some guys would walk out when Rav Chaim wanted to give shir, because they didn't want to walk out during the shir. So they'd walk out before the shir began. Okay? Rav Shimon Shkup was very poor. He didn't have Crocs. His shoes, the sole of his shoes, were off his foot. Were off the top. So he had to take his shoelace and tie it around the sole to keep the shoe together. It took him a few minutes to tie his shoes in the morning. You with me? So the story goes, he was leaving before Rav Chaim came. Shoelaces got untied. And he had to spend time tying the shoe in a fancy way. It took him a few minutes. He was stuck because Rav Chaim started giving shir. So he listened to one shir. And he was hooked, and he became a Talmid of Rav Chaim through that episode. And he thanked Hashem that he was so poor that he had to do the whole shoe thing. And that's how Rav Shimon Shkup got pulled into the Chaim's derech, and then he developed his own derech based on a Chaim as well. Okay, that's a Chaim in Volozhin. Those 12 years till it closed, that's how he spread the Brisker derech through Volozhin. Then the Beis Halevi dies, the Volozhin closes, and a Chaim takes over in Brisk, and until he dies in 1918, during World War I, he's the Rebbe in Brisk. In Brisk, Reb Chaim didn't have a yeshiva, but he had everyone came around to learn under Reb Chaim, the greatest people. He had a quasi-yeshiva in Brisk, where he spread his derech in Brisk as well. So that is Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was known as a tremendous Baal Chesed. He'd give away tzedakah all the time. The story goes that in Brisk, they took his salary, and instead of giving it to him, they'd give it to his wife directly, because they'd give him a salary, and as he's walking home on Friday, he would give all the money away to the Anim and have no money time for Shabbos when he got back. So they ended up giving Reb Chaim's salary to his wife, directly. That's what happened to him. He was Chesbal Chesed in Belushin. In Brisk, there are tremendous stories about like the Ish Halacha. If the Halacha says something, when the Rav wrote the Ish Halacha, that's his book on the Torah's approach to Halacha and fitting in and the philosophy of Halacha, really, he had in mind Reb Chaim, that you do what the Halacha says, no matter what else happens. Then there are tremendous stories there. Two people died on the same day, and the one who dies first is supposed to be buried first. And the one who died first was a poor man. The one who died second was a very wealthy man, a big supporter in Brisk of Reb Chaim. And so the Chevra Kedisha was burying the second one first, because he's the rich man. And Reb Chaim said, no, you can't do that. And they didn't listen. So Reb Chaim went out and led and said, and he stopped them. And he said, you have to take care of this other one first, because that's the halacha. That's a story. That's one famous story. There's another famous story that apparently once an Erev Yom Kippur, Reb Chaim heard about that a certain totally non-religious secular Jew was in trouble with the government. And he's been taken away, and who knows, you know, he'll end up probably being killed, you know, taken away to Siberia. The government's doing something with him. So the minhag was, if you could bribe them a certain way, you can get him out. So the story goes, on Erev Yom Kippur, Reb Chaim stopped the davening and said, we're not starting Kol Nidre till everyone goes home and gets their money. We're gathering money to pay off ransom, to bribe the authorities, to save this guy's life. And when people went home on Kippur and got their money, brought it back to Reb Chaim, and the boy's life was saved. This is Reb Chaim. Okay. Here's the story of Reb Chaim attempting to save the boy's life, the non-religious boy, even though it involved a desecration of Yom Kippur. It's in Rabbi Eric Heffet's book, About the Rav, Volume 1, page 234. This boy was sentenced to die. Reb Chaim received the news of this event on Erev Yom Kippur, before he went to shul. He knew that in Russia, bribes worked wonders. The trial was to take place on Yom Kippur morning in Warsaw. At that time, it was about a 7 or 8 hour journey from Brisk to Warsaw. Reb Chaim needed at least 3,000 rubles to cover the bribe and the expenses. What did Reb Chaim do? He closed all the shuls in Brisk except for one, and everyone came to this one big shul. Reb Chaim got up in Erev Yom Kippur and said, gentlemen, I want you to go home and open up your drawers and bring all the money you have to shul. We will not recite Kol Nidre until we collect the money. They thought the rabbi was out of the mind to tell the people to go home and carry money on Yom Kippur. This is what happened. In no time, Reb Chaim insisted, in no time, the people brought in the sum of 3,000 rubles. Instead of saying Kol Nidre, Reb Chaim went with a group of prominent laymen to the community to see the Ispravnik. They spoke with him, and somehow the money changed hands. The chief of police asked my grandfather to sign an affidavit on behalf of the boy to sign on Yom Kippur. My grandfather signed the affidavit right away. This shows the greatness of my grandfather, his loving kindness, and his feeling of communal responsibility. What an incredible story about Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim dies in 1918. Reb Chaim had more sons. He had two famous sons, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik and Reb Yitzchak Zeiv. We'll do Reb Yitzchak Zeiv first. Reb Yitzchak Zeiv, he's known as the Grizz, Hagaon Rav
Yitzhak Zeiv. That's one name he's given. Gaon Rav Yitzhak Zeiv. He's known as the Brisker Rav. Why is he called the Brisker Rav? Because after Rav Chaim died,
he became the Rav in Brisk. No, he didn't make it. Because the sheet's about the Rav. He became the Rav in Brisk. He's called the Brisker Rav. In 1918, he becomes the Rav in Brisk. He was a super giant as well. There are amazing stories about him. When he was a kid, Rav Chaim would send him on errands all the time. All the time. And then when he got back from the errands, Rav Chaim would test him what they had been learning, had he been working on it during the errands. And he says, my father was training me to be able to always be thinking and learning, even when I was involved in other things. Amazing idea. I mean, we would do the opposite. We would say, you know, don't do the errands, learn. And Rav Chaim, that's what he says about himself. And my father would do these things to train me to always be involved in learning, even when I was involved in other things. And he became the Rav in Brisk. And from 1918 until around 1940, I think, when he left Europe to come to Eretz Yisrael to avoid Hitler, Yimach Shema. And in Brisk, again, he with the way he worked with the Brisker Rav, he was very selective with his students. The greatest minds came to him, and they have a list in the books now. All the big names found their way to Brisk to learn under Rav Chaim, under the Brisker Rav. When he would, again, it wasn't a formal yeshiva, you know, like this, but it was like, you know, they come to hear from the Brisker Rav, and again, the names there are tremendous names. In 15 years in Brisk, he was giving shir, where he was all the big names were learning under the Brisker Rav. That's Rav Yitzchak Zeiv, the Grizz, the Brisker Rav. His years, he was born in 1886 and died in 1959. He comes to Israel around 1940, and he's there in Israel for around 18, 19 years. He became a big leader of the more Haredi world in Eretz. He and the Chazon Ish were considered the two of the main big leaders in the Haredi world in Eretz Yisrael around the time of the rise of the Medina. He comes to Israel, and his kids and grandkids are Brisk Yerushalayim. He comes to Israel, and you read the biography. It's fascinating. He bought a house here, and basically his house was a yeshiva. His kids are each learning in a different room, whatever they're learning, and he goes from kid to kid, discussing what each one's learning and their growth in learning. More or less, they were mostly were taught at home with him. Mostly fascinating. And all his kids and his grandkids were big time nechamim and, you know, magid eshir, etc. He had the yeshiva Brisk Yerushalayim, the Brisker Rav. Again, his style different than Rav Soloveitchik. In his style, only the top guys were in the shiur. His shiurim were small, 20 guys, 30 guys. But again, a lot of the big names in Eretz Yisrael came to and under the Brisker Rav here in Eretz, and he had a tremendous influence here. Again, through his shiurim. In those years, the best people came to Dishim. That's the Brisker Rav. There are a lot of stories about him, the way they, the stories that they I heard, it's like this. Rav Shechter and Wayu, Rabbi Rav Shechter Shlief, he went under the Rav. He has a lot of stories from the Brisker Rav as well. How? Because one of the Brisker Rav's Talmidim's name was Rav Gurelik. Rav Gurelik, that's all. Rav Gurelik, that's all, learned under the Brisker Rav in Brisk. I don't know if it was in Eretz Yisrael too. And he comes to America. So Rav Gurelik was a Rebbe in YU. And he had a lot of Brisker Rav Torah and stories from Brisk. And Rav Shechter spent a few years in Rav Gurelik's shir. So Rav Shechter has a lot of the Brisker Rav stories coming through Rav Gurelik. You with me on that? So he tells a story that's like this. Rav Chaim had a certain derech of learning. We discussed a little bit. Okay. The Evan HaEzel is Rav Zalman Meltzer. Rav Zalman Meltzer was a great Rosh Yeshiva in Europe and in Eretz Yisrael, and he would appear on the Rambam, Evan Ezel. And in his introduction, he has a line where he makes a comment where he talks about, you know, like, he uses the word chemistry. And he says that you don't have to answer every Rambam, you can't answer every kasha on a Rambam with a chemical formula. I mean, that was a bit of a knock against the Brisker Derech. They use precision and definition. It's almost like chemistry. Sounds like a bit of a knock. So that's what he writes. He writes, you can't use a chemical formula to answer every. You can't answer every Rambam with a chemical formula. So they brought this to the Brisker Rav. This was an introduction. They said, Rebbe, look what he wrote. He says you can't use every. You can't answer every Rambam with a chemical formula. So the Brisker Rav said, he can't. That's the way the brisk, that's the style of thought. The style of Beitich have a lot of self-confidence. He said, he can't. Okay, and that's what, that's the brisk era. Okay, he had tremendous influence. His son, right now there are three main brisk Yerushalayim yeshivas. His son David, Rabbi Meshulam David Soloveitchik, and this is a smaller brisk that it's his son have not been published, his chedushim on Kachim. That's a son. Then the biggest brisk, Rav Avraham Yehoshua, is a grandson of the brisk Rav, from a different son. I'm not sure which were from a different son. The last name Soloveitchik, son, grandson. This is the biggest brisk Yerushalayim. There is a third brisk Yerushalayim. The Rosh Shiva's name is Rav Tzvi Kaplan. Ah, he has the wrong last name. Rav Tzvi Kaplan married the Brisker Rav's granddaughter. Brisker Rav's daughter married Rav Michal Feinstein. Rav Michal Feinstein's daughter is married to Rav Tzvi Kaplan. So Rav Tzvi Kaplan spent, I think, 14 years learning under Avraham Yehoshua. In the big yeshivas, the way it works is there are six or seven mesechtas. That's the cycle. You go through the cycle. In Brisk, they learn Kachim. So Rav Tzvi went through the whole cycle with Avraham Yehoshua twice. And then he was ready, then he opened his own yeshiva. That's Rav Tzvi Kaplan. Rav Tzvi Kaplan's mother is Mrs. Ginsburg's father's first cousin. Rav Tzvi Kaplan's mother is a first cousin to my wife's father, which makes them the second cousins. So Rav Tzvi Kaplan is my wife's second cousin, and that gives him a lot of yichus. Now, so that's Rav Tzvi Kaplan. So this is brisk, and this is a fabulous yeshiva. People go, he's amazing. He has a big yeshiva, and they wrote an article about it. He goes over every week, every name in the yeshiva, like what he's up to, what he's doing. If you meet him, he's an amazing person. See, we made Aliyah, he's the oldest of 15 kids. His father is Avruchim Kaplan, who is the grandson of Avruchim from Mir. That's right. So 15 kids, he's the oldest. So we made Aliyah. So we spent a few Shabbos there. So at the Shabbos table, his father, after the soup, every Shabbos, gives a solid half-hour Hashkafa Musar Shmuz at the Shabbos table. All the kids, the grandkids, they sing Zmiros, and then all the kids go to Cheder, a certain Cheder that they like in Yerushalayim. All the kids go to Panovich for Yeshiva Ktana, then come back, because that was the best one, and then come back to Brisk afterwards for Yeshiva. And what's amazing, what I found amazing was, when I was there, the littlest kids were 10, 11. They were learning Gemara. I'm a little older, not 10, 11. They're older than that. So they were learning. So one of them was talking about a Ritva and Kedushin. And at the table, all the boys at the table were holding the Ritva and Kedushin. The family is 10 boys and 5 girls, 15 kids. And like that's mamash, you know, each one's a Rosh Yeshiva. One of his brothers is a Rosh Yeshiva in Magichir in Or HaChaim in Queens with Rabbi Lanter. One of his brothers lives in America. We'll get this later with Rabbi Landon. It's an amazing thing. We made Aliyah, and we came to Beit Vegan with our stuff. It was a whole story. The day after we come to Beit Vegan, his four unmarried daughters at the time show up at our house to help us unpack. And you have to know what the family is. This is the family. And it was like when we told my in-laws, oh, yeah, of course, that's what they would do. That's what they do. The daughters come and they help us unpack. Like, you know, they invite us for Shabbos, always helping us, whatever. So that's Rav Tzvi Kaplan. That's his family, 15 kids, 10 boys, 5 girls. And mamash, a powerhouse family. Powerhouse family. So his son married the Brisker Rav's granddaughter. He has another daughter who married the Brisker Rav's grandson. He's mechutan twice with Rav Michal Feinstein. It's they have, I think, more than 80 grandchildren now. Like we get an invitation literally every month. There's a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a bris, a pidyon haben, a simcha, a vort. I mean, because, you know, with 15 kids, each one has a lot of kids himself. This is a powerhouse. That's okay. You with me? That's Brisk Yerushalayim. That's the Brisker Rav. And that's this world. And the Brisker Rav took over from Reb Chaim in Brisk, 1918, when Reb Chaim died during World War I. The Brisker Rav was around 10 years younger than his older brother, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, which we'll get to in a second. This is the Brisker Rav. This is... Okay. Now, Reb Chaim's oldest son was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim's oldest son, again, a huge, giant Talmud Chacham himself, and he was a Magid Shir in different places, and he ended up as the Rav of the city of Chaslavich. That's the name of the city, Chaslavich. It was a Lubavitcher town, which always had a non-Lubavitcher Rav. There's a legend about this town, that the legend goes that the reason why there was always a non-Lubavitcher Rav of this town was because in the war between France and Russia, Napoleon and Russia, so there was a whole machlokes amongst the Gedolim, who should we support? France was a more open, Western, open country, more freedom. Maybe it's better for the Jews to have more freedom. On the other hand, maybe more freedom is bad for the Jews because more freedom means more secular influence. Maybe it's better if Russia wins. So that was a machlokes. And the Baal HaTanya supported Russia. He wanted Russia to win. Okay. And apparently he used influence to actually try to help the Russian cause with spies or whatever. He was helping the Russian cause, apparently. So Napoleon found out about this. He was upset. And they were chasing him down. And apparently they chased him down in Chaslavich, if I'm not mistaken. And they were searching house to house to go find the Baal HaTanya and kill him, or whatever, more or less kill him. Well, so then the Rav in Chaslavich, who was not a Lubavitcher, a Misnagid, so he hid him in his basement. And when they came, they knocked on the door, they said, look, we hate the Chassidim. I hate the Chassidim more than anyone. And I'm telling you, he's not here. You don't have to check my house. And they went on. So he saved his life. So from that time on, in Chaslavich, which was a Lubavitcher town, they always had a non-Lubavitcher Rav. That's the way he writes the story over here. I also wanted to read the story about the Mesorah, that in Chaslavich, they would have a non-Chassidish Rav, even though the town was mostly Lubavitch. This is Rabbi Kefet's book, Volume 1, page 257. When Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812, there was a great controversy between the Hasidic Rebbeim as to whom they should support. Rav Lev Yitzchak Rabbeinu supported Napoleon because the Russian Tsars were very oppressive of the Jews. On the other hand, Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi, the founder of Chabad Hasidism, held the opposite point of view. He felt that while physically it would be better for the Jews if Napoleon won, it would be disastrous on a spiritual level. A victory for Napoleon would open the gates to the spirit of assimilation, which was then engulfing Western Europe. And the Baal HaTanya was actively helped. He actively helped the Russian side. That's what the Rav here quotes in the story. The French knew of the activities of Rav Shneur Zalman. The word went out that the French wanted to capture him, dead or alive. On the move, he reached the town of Chaslavich and sought a place to hide. And one of the Rabbanim there hid the first Lubavitch Rebbe in his home. It is related that when the French forces came into Chaslavich searching for the Rebbe, they did not even bother to carefully look in the home of Yisrael Ashkenazi. After all, he was a misnagid, and they did not suspect that he would save a Hasidic Rebbe. So the Baal HaTanya was saved. This is the story that the Lubavitcher Hasidim constantly retold. As a result of this episode, it was enacted that in Chaslavich, the rabbi would always be a misnagid, and preferably from the family or students of the Vilna Gaon, because this Rav, Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi, was a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, the author of the Pa'at HaShulchan. That's one version of the story. And the Rav also told a different time, a slightly different but similar version of the story. Yes, it's the same Rav, Rabbi Saul Ashkenazi. Here it says that they knocked on his door, and Rabbi Saul told them that he would immediately surrender any Hasidic leader to them, but he did not know where the Rabbi of Vladi was, where the Baal HaTanya was. So it's two slightly different versions of the story. In my eyes, the Rav said, the story was authentic. In my youth, I heard it from many of the older Hasidim in Chaslavich. I learned a great deal about Chabad when I resided there. It's a fabulous story explaining why a Daf Ganan Chassidish Rav, who is linked up to the Vilna Gaon, was always the Rav in Chaslavich, because of how a Talmud of Vilna Gaon saved the life of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he's the Rav in Chaslavich. That's a Moshe Soloveitchik. Okay. In Chaslavich, okay, so he had three, he had more sons. He had three sons that I know about. His oldest son was the Rav, the middle son was Rav Shmuel, and the youngest son was Rav Aaron. Okay, his oldest son was the Rav, and the story goes, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik spent a huge amount of time teaching the Rav Torah one-on-one. The story goes that Rav Moshe sent the Rav to Cheder in Chaslavich, and the Rav's Rebbe was a Lubavitcher Chassid. So instead of learning Gemara, he would teach them Tanya. So the Rav was really holding in Tanya. Then one day the Rav's mother noticed that the Rav wasn't holding Gemara like he was supposed to. She tested him, or her husband tested him. He wasn't holding Gemara, took him out of Cheder and taught him privately. And for around 15 years or 13 years, Rav Moshe spent most of his day sitting with the Rav, learning one-on-one in the local shul. That was the only place that had heat the whole day. It was a very poor town. Learning one-on-one. And the Rav, it's amazing, for decades, has fond memories of the Baal HaTanya and the Sefer HaTanya. He would use it a lot and quote it a lot from when he learned the Tanya as a little kid. Like, it was like his first learning when he was in Cheder with his Lubavitcher Rebbe. Then there is an incredible story, which apparently it's in the book, and the people who were involved, they're alive, you can call them. In the late 1960s, people began going to Russia, to support Russian Jewry and give chizuk to Russian Jewry. So some boys and some young rabbis from YU Muslims went to Russia, and they were in different towns, and they were talking Yiddish, and there's a guy there who said, "Oh, you Yiddish, where are you from?" "America." And he went, "Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik." He said, "Oh, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik, yes." And he said, he was the Malami. He was alive sitting in Russia somewhere. The Rav didn't know about this. And he said, "Tell your Rebbe that Baruch from Chaslavich, sends greetings." So they come back, it's in the book, they come back to the Rav, and they tell him the story. The Rav was stunned, still alive. He had no idea he was alive still. He said, "It can't be true." They said, "Rebbe, you never told us his name. You never told us his name." And they said to the Rav, his name, Rav Baruch from says hello. Unbelievable. This guy's still alive. So he survived somehow through in the Rush, over there in Russia. And that was the Rav's Malamed. So Moshe Soloveitchik is in Europe, and he decides to get out in the early 30s. 1932, he died in 1941. 1932 comes to America and becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of YU. And for 9 years, from 32 to 41, Rav Moshe, this is amazing, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's oldest son is the Magid Shir in YU from 1930 to 1941. And then he died suddenly in 1941 at not such an old age. And lo aleinu. And that's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And he himself was a super giant. And he put all of his kolchos into developing the Rav, to make the Rav great. So Rav Moshe dies, he's in America around 10 years. He dies in 1941 when he was Rosh Shiva of YU. That's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Okay. Now, his three sons. We'll do the Rav last. His middle son was Rav Shmuel. Rav Shmuel was a chemistry teacher in YU. Big time. And all the guys liked to take his classes because he had an older brother who was a Gadol Hador, and a younger brother was a Gadol Hador. He had the best stories. And a lot of the best Soloveitchik stories that come out come through him. And they learned a lot about the Soloveitchik through his class. That's Rav Shmuel Soloveitchik. He was in between the Rav and Rav Aaron. All right. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was Rav Moshe's youngest son. He was 15 years younger than the Rav. It's fascinating. So when the Rav was like 23 years old, he's a gadol already. Rav Aaron's 8. So Rav Aaron describes what it's like growing up, that your father's a gadol, and your older brother, like we play ball with, your older brother is mamish a gadol. And he has fascinating stories. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, you can talk about for hours, but he tells stories about himself, again, this about his Seder, what a Seder was like, and he said as follows. He was talking about that Rav Aaron said, he said, my father was soft with me. He never hit me. So Rav Aaron said, when he was much younger, he said, my father was very soft with me. My father never hit me. He said, there was one time that my father threatened to hit me. Here's the time. This is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He said, I was 6 years old. It was Yom Kippur. And I wanted to fast on Yom Kippur. So I didn't eat at night. The next morning, my father said, you have to eat. You're little. He told me to eat. He gave me the food, went to shul. I tricked him. I didn't eat the food. And I pushed it aside. I didn't eat the food. So I'm in shul and I'm davening. And I mentioned Musaf time to my older brother, the Rav, that I'm still fasting. Now, briskers are very nervous about fasting, pikuach nefesh. They're known to be very, very big machmirim, that if something might affect your health, and maybe, pikuach nefesh, there are amazing stories about the briskers with safek pikuach nefesh stories. So Rav Aaron said, my brother, the Rav, snitched on me. He's 23, he's a gadol, and he's 21. He told my father that I was still fasting. So the Rav, the gadol, tells his father, Rav Moshe, the gadol, that the little brother, the 6-7-year-old Rav Aaron, is still fasting. So Moshe took him home and said, you have to eat. He says, Abba, I don't want to eat, Tati. He says, you have to eat. And he was chasing him out of the table. My father said to me, if you don't eat, I'm going to have to hit you. So then I ate something. So that's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. The one time his father had to threaten to hit him was when he wanted to fast the whole day on Yom Kippur as a little kid. That's a future gadol. I heard that story myself. He was giving when I was in YU. That's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik grew up in America. He was in America around the time, right after his bar mitzvah, around the time 14, 15, and he learned under his father in YU, in his father's shirim, under his father. And he built himself, but again, it wasn't one-on-one like with the Rav, but it was like with the Rav. And he became a super giant himself. He was in Chaim Berlin for a while. He was a Magid Shir in Chaim Berlin for a while. He went to Chicago for a while, the Shiva of Skokie. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was a Shiva in Skokie for a while, and he ended up leaving Skokie, he was in YU for a while first, then he was in Skokie, then he came back to YU, and after what happened in Skokie, he opened a small yeshivas brisk in Chicago. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik headed a small yeshiva brisk in Chicago for like 20, 25 years, and then later came back to YU, and he would commute from YU to Boston, to Chicago, a couple of days in Chicago, a couple of days in YU. When he came back to YU, I was there, and I heard Parsha Hashkafa class from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, fabulous classes, Hashkafa and inspiration from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in the 1980s. That was Rav Aaron Brown was an amazing person, very, very independent, very strong. I remember in the early 80s when this whole Oslo thing was starting, he was yelling. He was very strong, yelling, "You're giving guns to murderers and guns to Arafat. It's terrible." And he was already came out wheelchair bound at that time it was the late 80s. And he flew to Israel to see Rabin when the peace process, quote unquote, was starting, to give him Musar. And he told us about it. Now, he was in a wheelchair. In Hebrew, if you're wheelchair bound, there's a term called shatuk. Does that make sense? Mishutak means you're stuck in a wheelchair. So Rabin comes there, and Rabin said to him, he came all the way to give him Musar. And he said to him, Rabin said, you know, Mishutak. He said, Ani Shatuk, whatever, Abba Ani Lo Shotek. I'm not going to be quiet. And Rav Aaron told us, he said the following to Yitzhak Rabin. Rabin was one of the ones who helped conquer Yerushalayim in the Six-Day War. You know, and we have Yom Yerushalayim. So Rav Aaron said to Yitzhak Rabin, he told us this, he said, you're not a religious man. And you're going to have a problem. because you don't do mitzvahs. But the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, a person can be kono olam haba in one show. You do one great deed, you're kono olam haba. So Avraham said, I said to Yitzhak Rabin, when you helped conquer Yerushalayim, you were kono olam haba, that's your ticket in. He said, but the process you're starting now, you're losing it. If you start the process now, it's leading to giving away Yerushalayim, and the same way you can be kono olam haba b'sha'achas, you can lose it like that, and that's the Musa B'gay. Okay, I don't know if it helped, but that's what he said. Rav Aaron was very into details. That's the way he talked. Like he could tell you the flights from Chicago to New York, if you go through Cleveland and go through, he's into that. And he'd use it in Shir. And once in Shir, I wasn't there, but I heard the tape. He was quoting a vort he heard from his father, and he said in Shir, I heard this vort from my father 55 years ago. And he told me he heard this vort from his father, Reb Chaim, 55 years before that. So this Dvar Torah is 110 years old. Imagine you're sitting in a shir, and a gadol says to you, what I'm saying to you now was brought into the world 110 years ago. That's the way he spoke. That's Avraham Salvator. The man was a tzaddik. There's a book called Touched by a Story. Seen those books? They're great books. There's a story in there, Touched by a Story, about a guy named Mark Stein from Chicago. Mark Stein was a businessman who had tickets to the Chicago Bears football games at Soldier Field. Aleva Shalom, Soldier Field?
No. They redid it.
Oh, they redid it. It's not destroyed. It's redone? Slicha. Slicha. I stand corrected. What? It's Chias Amazing. It says Soldier Field. So Mark Stein's sitting there, and he meets a guy next to him, and they exchange business cards. Okay, they exchange business cards. All right. And they're talking, fine. And the guy noticed that he's Jewish. He goes, "Oh yeah, I'm Jewish. Yeah." Wait. I'm butchering the story. 1 second. I just want to read the story read some of the story about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik from the book called "Touched by a Story." It's describing there's a football game. And Mark Stein is at the football game, and he had a good seats in an area that was shielded from the wind, etc. He met the person next to him, who was a successful businessman, and they swapped business contracts. Jerry, the person next to him, noticed Mark's name. Are you Jewish? Mark answered that he was. Why? Do you know any Jews in Chicago? Only one. And it's not me, it's my wife who does. His name is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Do you know him? The look on Mark's face changed from one of pleasantness to sadness. Well, of course I know him. He was one of the greatest rabbis in Chicago. But I'm sorry to inform you that Rabbi Soloveitchik passed away last week. What? I don't believe it. A look of sadness and shock appeared on Jerry's face. Jerry immediately used his cell phone to call his wife. Lisa, it's me, Jerry said slowly. Sit down. I have some terrible news to share with you. Rabbi Soloveitchik passed away last week. Jerry looked up at his new acquaintance and motioned that his wife was crying. All right, I'll call you back soon, just to make sure that you're okay. Jerry turned to Mark and began to explain. She has been a stewardess for the past few years on American Airlines. Every week, Rabbi Soloveitchik would fly from Chicago to New York. He told my wife that he went there to teach ever since his brother passed away. He sat in first class. Most of the passengers in first class pretty much ignore the flight crew. But the rabbi took a genuine interest in the welfare of my wife and the rest of the crew. He knew their families and all the important things that were happening in their lives. So my wife feels like she's lost someone special in her life. Mark was humbled. Here he was sitting at Soldier Field next to a Gentile whose wife, a stewardess, was extremely saddened over the loss of Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav could have kept to himself on his flights. Everyone else did, but instead he had decided to make a difference, to make a Kiddush Hashem. Mark had come to the football game to get away and enjoy himself for the afternoon. Little did he know that he would learn a lesson about how a person should conduct himself at each and every moment of his life. This is a classic story about Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. If you knew him, if you met him, it exactly fits with who he was. This is Rav Aaron. On the airline that Rav Aaron flew from Chicago to New York, and meeting him was such a moving experience. He'd say, hello, how are you? He's a very, very, just completely pleasant, positive person with all his difficulties. And she was so moved by that relationship When her husband heard that Rav Aaron died, he calls her and she's crying. A goy, a non-Jewish stewardess, is crying on the phone when he hears that Rav Aaron died. And Mark Stein says, oh my gosh, you know, look at what we've lost. I should appreciate what we've lost. That story isn't touched by a story. You know Rav Aaron, it fits with who he was. Rav Aaron had a certain way of speaking. He'd say, but, I mean, so. It's certain things he would say. And he had a voice that was very easy to imitate. And all his talmidim would imitate him. I had a friend who could imitate him perfectly. So, I mean, so. Okay, so the story goes that everyone imitates Rav Aaron. So a guy gets a phone call, and the person on the other line says, hello, I mean, but can I please speak with Yosef? So Yosef thinks it's his friend imitating him, Rav Aaron. He says, he's not here right now. Maybe you should call back later. So he imitates Rav Aaron, how Rav Aaron would talk to tell the guy on the phone, Rav Aaron, that Yosef's not here. Okay. So then there's a pause, and he says, okay, I will call back later. Then he hangs up. So now Yosef's got a little nervous. He starts calling his friends. Did you call me? You know, to imitate Rav Aaron? And they said, no. So he realized that was Rav Aaron. So when Rav Aaron called him on the phone, he had imitated Rav Aaron to Rav Aaron. It's a famous story. So the guy's nervous. He calls up Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron's wife answers. So the story goes, she says, oh, hello, this is Yosef. Can I speak to Rebbe, please? She goes, oh, yes, we were expecting your call. You know, okay, we're expecting your call. Fine. So then he gets on the phone, and Rav Aaron says right away, I was mochi you right away. Imitation is the highest form of flattery. It's okay, I was mochi. I know the boys, it's imitation right away. It was mochi. The guy was embarrassed, asking for forgiveness. If you know Rav Aaron, that's a classic story. You could so easily see it happening with Rav Aaron. Okay. When I was in YU, Rav Aaron had a difficult, certain physically difficult life. He had two strokes, and I was there in between, I think, the two strokes when he was there. And he walked with a heavy walker. He lost most of use of his left arm. You had to watch him. His left arm would shake. And to watch the man put on a tefillin in the morning, it would take him minutes to put on tefillin, to do the mitzvah by himself with his tefillin, this and that, on and on. And he liked to walk by himself, not without help, and he had a walker. And so I saw him give parsha classes. He's an old man. He's hunched over, walking like this. And it would take him, let's say, from the door to the back of the room, I don't know, 3 minutes to walk. That's an eternity. From here to 3 minutes to walk there. He'd sit and huffing and puffing, and I saw this week in, week out, giving a shir, and you're giving a shir, you're in the Masorah, and you come to life. And I saw this old man, broken, barely, breathing heavily, give a shir 2 hours, 2.5. We stopped for Marv because it was time to die for Marv. He could have gone on longer. And you see a person come to life through the Koach of Torah. I saw this myself. This is not the... I saw it myself. This was before the age of video with cell phones. I was for sure, it was, you know, right there, get the video right there. We didn't have that stuff in my day. And it was amazing, the tremendous chizuk I got just watching him. And he would tell stories about Europe and the Masorah. When I felt I was like, mamish, in the Masorah, is hearing Rav Aaron tell stories and give shir, and you watch the person, mamish, come to life through the Torah. We'll see, they said the same thing about the Rav. That's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. That's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He was a nifter in 2002. He has all his sons at Beit HaMelech Chachamim. He has his youngest son is Rav of a shul in Beit Shemesh, Ramat Beit Shemesh. His name is Chaim Soloveitchik, wonderful person, Beit HaMelech Chacham. One of his sons used to be in Brisk Yerushalayim, now he's in Landers, Rav Eliyahu Soloveitchik, fabulous Magid Shir. I'm hooked. I heard him give two or three shears. I am hooked. He also has a chayin about him. He has other sons who are geniuses, and holding in Brisket Torah all over the place. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was this tremendous person, just to learn from, just watching him go through his life. There's what to learn from. There is a famous article he wrote. He wrote an article about after his stroke. I'll just say one point. After his stroke, he lost most use of his left arm. So he said that after his stroke, he chopped, pshat, in the Chazal, or in the, maybe it's Kabbalah, that it says that Hashem's right side is Chesed, and left side is Din. That's what Chazal say. Right? That's what the Mishnah Berurah says. How come when you wash your right, you wash your right hand first, then your left hand? Why do you do that? So the Mishnah Berurah quotes, the reason is, your right side of Hashem is Chesed. We want to have Hashem Chesed. We do things with the right first, to emphasize Chesed over Din. Alright. So what's the pshat, that the right side is Chesed, the left side is Din? So Ryan said as follows. When you write with your right hand. But normally you use your left hand to hold the paper. And he said when he went to write after his stroke, he couldn't write normally. Because without his left hand holding the page, he couldn't get the right balance. You with me? He said, that's the pshat. Hashem's right side is chesed, Hashem is tov. Hashem wants to give, and make it good for us, give us whatever he can. But sometimes, we don't deserve the things that we need. That we don't deserve what Hashem wants to give us. Because we do aveiros. So Hashem has to punish us. That's din. But why does Hashem punish us? He's punishing us in order what? That we should do tshuva to what? Be deserving of more of the good stuff with the right side, with the chesed. So Hashem's left side, in a sense, is the weaker hand that is serving the right. You got that? It's a fabulous pshat. He said he understood that pshat of chesed and din after his stroke when he couldn't write without his left hand. Oh, that the left hand is needed to help. It's like basketball. The left hand holds, the issue. Okay. That's what Rav Aaron said. The article gives such chizuk. This is what he's thinking about after his stroke. That's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Okay. Then you come to the Rav. Okay, the Rav was born 1903 till 1993. As a young man, he learned mostly under his father, and his father taught him a good... The Rav once listed in a public shiur, like the Masechtas, he learned word by word with his father. His father taught him, I think, most of Shas. They learned Shas B'Yun together, word by word. And the Rav, until the age of 16 or 17, only learned. Then he received the equivalent of a high school education, through in a local town somewhere. And then, in his mid-20s, he went to Berlin, and he went to university, and he ended up with a PhD in something from the University of Berlin. So his core, his base, until his late teens, was Torah, and then he spread out more into the secular knowledge as well. And they published, around 10 years ago, the letters he was writing back and forth to his father when he was in Berlin about the sugyas he was working on and learning, totally learning B'Yun there as well. So the Rav as a child was totally involved in learning, and he describes what it was like. The Rav, who was the Rav's best friend as a kid? Who was his best friend? Who was his best friend?
Moshe.
The Rambam. The Rav writes about, my best friend was the Rambam. How do we meet? We met in the house. My father's giving shir. I'm in bed, and I'm listening to my father give shir, and he describes, it's unbelievable, his descriptions, that the Rambam is being attacked, and my father is defending the Rambam, and when my father would give a shot in the Rambam, I jump up, yay, the Rambam won, and I tell my mom, the Rambam won, but once in a while, my father couldn't answer the Rambam, and I felt the Rambam was being attacked, and he lost his fight, and he said, he's 6 years old, I go crying to my mother, mommy, how do you say mama in Yiddish? What's the, mama. Mama, the Rambam lost. What are we going to do? She said to me, okay, maybe later Abba Tati will have an answer for the Rambam, father. And when you get older, maybe you'll have an answer for the Rambam. The key thing in life is to learn Torah with enthusiasm and with simcha. That's the way he quotes it. That's when he was a kid. And the Rambam was alive. And he said, my best friend was the Rambam. That's what the Rav said. I mean, and it's in his books. Rav Schechter mentioned once in a shir that the Rav once said, the Rav Schechter said that he completed the Minchas Chinuch before his bar mitzvah. Now, if you open up Minchas Chinuch, Rav Schechter said, that is quite a feat. You have to know Shas. The Minchas Chinuch is, assuming you know Shas, the Minchas Chinuch is the ultimate what if question. What if a Chatzi Eved, Chatzi Ben Chorin decides to do this, to do that? It's all the what ifs. You have to be holding in Shas, be showing him to begin with. To finish the Minchas Chinuch by your bar mitzvah, it's hard to absorb such a fact. And that's how the Rav Schechter quoted from the Rav, a total giant. The Rav met Rav Chaim only a few times, because the Rav died when Rav Chaim died, the Rav was 15. A few times he met Rav Chaim, and he sent him some Chiddushei Torah when he was a young boy, and Rav Chaim supposedly was so excited about the Chiddushei Torah that the Rav sent. Okay, this is the Rav. The Rav comes to America in 32, right, 29 years old, he has his PhD, and he's married, and he comes to Boston. Originally, it's interesting, who brought the Rav to America? In those days, you couldn't come to America unless you had a job waiting for you. That was some sort of law like that. which institution brought the Rav to America? And this is one of those hidden secrets. Who knows? Anyone know? What? Skokie. Skokie, they signed the paper that we have a position for the Rav to bring him to Chicago. When he got there, they had no money, and they couldn't offer him a job, and he ended up in Boston, and he became one of the Ravs of the Shoals in Boston. He was in Boston then. Okay. That's the Rav. The Rav was in Boston, and he got involved when he got there in Kashrus. And there was a tremendous scandal. The Rav took over the Kashrus there, and there was, back in those days, the mafia was involved. There were a lot of things going on. And basically, the Shochtim were worked to the bone, and they were tired, and it was hard. And the Rav cleaned up the whole Shechita business in Chicago, and in Boston. To do this, he had to put up, it was a penny stamp. It was a stamp he put on all the chickens that to make sure that to govern the Kashrus better. And it was a penny each, which was a lot of money back then. And all that money, all those extra pennies went to pay the Shochtim, give them a normal life, they can have, okay. So the other Rabbanim who were there, who were upset the Rav was changing everything, they accused the Rav of skimming money from these pennies off the top. And the Rav, I don't think he was indicted, but he was under investigation. And it was a year and a half investigation done by the attorney, one of the local big attorneys. He wrote a long report, and the report said, basically after a year and a half, I've never seen a more honest person in my life. And he goes over and bends over backwards, this and that. And his name was Cohen, who wrote this article. It's a famous thing. But the Rav was burnt by that, and he got out of Kashrus and not involved anymore. And his whole life, that was the Rav in Boston. Around 40 years later, one of the Rabbanim who was against him originally was caught in some sort of scandal with taxes and this. And this Rav's family sent the Rav a letter saying, please, will Rav Soloveitchik write a letter to the judge to ask for mercy and give, rachmanis to our father. And the Rav said, sure, and he wrote the letter. They said, this is the guy who tried to get you in jail. If you see his whole style, he was attacked here and there. He went on with his business, teaching Torah, spread about. It's an amazing story. The same guy who mamish tried to get him in jail, trouble 40, the Rav wrote him a letter to help him. That's a famous story. The people who are in the inside, they know all the names. Okay. The Rav's in Boston. The Rav taught Torah in Boston. He had a little kollel in Boston with Rav Michael Feinstein. This Rav Michael Feinstein, the son-in-law of the Brisker Rav, was in Boston with the Rav for a couple of years. They had a little advanced kollel there. It was one of the first kollels in America. And the people who were there, they tell these amazing stories. The Rav had no clock. Bristol was no clock. If the Rav thought of a chiddush at 3 in the morning, he'd wake up, okay, go, let's shears now. Okay, I got shot in the Rambam, wake guys up. And the people who are alive now, they'll tell you this. The Rav would wake them up at 3 in the morning to have a shear. That's just the way, you started your chiddush. It wasn't like you get up at 9 and Seder and this. Whenever the chiddush was ready, you had shear. Okay. The Rav's there in Boston. In 41, his father dies suddenly. It was unexpected. And a few months later, there was a little bit of politics. A few months later, the Rav in 41 becomes Magid Shir in YU, and he basically gives Shir till 83. So for roughly 42 years, the Rav is giving Shir in YU, the top Shir in YU. That's what's happening. The Rav was sick when he was older, and he couldn't think clearly. And 83, he basically stopped giving Shir. By 85, around then, and for the last 8-9 years of his life, he was living in one of his daughter's homes in Boston, and he was not really functioning for the public. And then he was nifter in 93. So basically, he gave Shir for I think 43 years in YU. Those 43 years in YU, he put a stamp on Orthodoxy in America and all over the world. Most of the big rabbanim in America, and he gave smicha to thousands of people. And through the big Magid Shir in New York, he spread, Torah in. He never left Boston. He lived in Boston. He came to YU to give shiur Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. Some days, some weeks, some years he came Tuesdays and Wednesdays, the different schedules. And from Thursday through Monday, he's in Boston. And Monday to Wednesday, he's in YU. In Boston, on Thursday through Monday, he'd give shiur in Boston. And he'd learn. He has three kids. His daughter married Rabbi Dr. Yitzchak Chorsky Zatzal. He was the Talmud Rebbe in Boston, Yitzchak Chorsky. He also was, I think, the only ever Hasidic Rebbe to be the head of the philosophy, Jewish history department in Harvard. unique individual. That was his son-in-law. So his, Sir Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky's sons are big, big lamdanim. One is Rav Moshe Twersky, Rebbe in Taurus Moshe. One is Rav Meir Twersky, a major Rebbe in YU. So the Rav would learn with his son-in-law, with his grandsons, and he describes his life, like his weekly schedule, learning several hours a week with all of them. That was, okay. He has a son, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who is a Talmud slash historian. And then his, oh no, sorry, married Rabbi Lichtenstein, Shlita, the Rosh Rav of Gush. Rav Lichtenstein is the Rav's son-in-law. So the Rav gives shir for 40-ish years in YU. And this is not all his Rebbeim, but the list of Rebbeim there, it's very impressive. It's all the Rabbanit Rosh Yeshiva of YU. And Rosh Yeshiva's all over the place. There are many more than this. In general, people consider Rav Shechter and Rav Lichtenstein the Rav's greatest Talmidim. They're both Gedolim themselves. Rebbe in YU, Rav Willard, Rav Rosenzweig, they all went under the Rav. Rabbi Reichman, he's under the Rav for many years. Maybe the most. He's written up a lot of the Rav's Chiddushim in his Sfarim. And big Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Braunschweig and Rav Pater. Rav Braunschweig was in the Rav Shir many years, of Abba Braunschweig. And Rav Pater was in the Rav Shir for a little while. These are the two Rebbeim. When Landers opened, they left YU to give Landers its jump start. Rav Braunschweig and Rav Pater, and that helped Landers get off the ground. That two of the Rav's major Talmidim gave Shir in YU for many years, left YU to go to Landers, so that's Rav Braunschweig and Rav Parnas. Okay, these are all the Rav's Talmidim. There are many more. Now in YU, you have the second generation of the Rav's Talmidim. Rabbi Simon Zibolovsky and Rabbi Sachs are three tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. Tremendous. Mamash, each one in its own way, holding from A to Z in Kol Tor Kula. It's an unbelievable thing. And they are Talmidim of mostly Rav Shechter and Rav Willig. These two for sure went to the Rav Shir. I'm not sure if Rabbi Sachs was on the border. I don't know if he was ever in the Rav Shir. Maybe if he was, it was at the very end. But the Rabbi Simon and Rabbi Zibolovsky are like the two greatest of the second generation of the Rav's Talmidim in YU. And you know, this is there's Rav Neuberger, the Talmud of the Rav. He's, you know, Rav Bergenfield as well. Okay, the Rav has many other Rabbi Lander. Now Rabbi Lander, Rosh Yeshiva of Or Chaim in Queens. Rabbi Lander's father is Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander, Bernie Lander. Lander's College, Truro College, that's Dr. Lander. So he's a Talmud Chacham, but mostly he's a builder. He just builds. He builds everything. He builds Turo's everywhere. Lander's is everywhere. It's just everywhere. It's unbelievable what Turo's accomplishing. His father, Dr. Lander, has smicha from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He was in YU in the 30s in the Rav's father's shir. That's Rabbi Dr. Bernie Lander. My father was close with him. When he opened the Turo Law School, Dr. Lander gently forced my father to become the dean of the law school. So for 2 years, my father commuted from New York to Silver Spring. He was in New York for 4 days a week and came back down to Silver Spring. And he started Turo Law School. He's very close with Dr. Lander. And my brothers were in Turo then, so they had an apartment together. My father and my two brothers had an apartment together. And my mother would cook 40 schnitzels and like 80 hamburgers and bring it up. And they left and that set up for the week. That was a whole to-do. Anyway, so Rabbi Lander was a fabulous Talmud Chacham. He was in the Rav Shir for many years. He opened Or Chaim in Queens. He's a big, big lamdan himself, Rabbi Lander. I'll just tell you a story. Rabbi Lander gives tremendous Shabbos HaGadol drushes. Tremendous. So when I'm in the States for Pesach, if it works out the timing, my in-laws live in Kew Garden Hills. Okay, so once he gave a shir on Karpas. Knockout shir. The Lumbus of Karpas. Tremendous. So there's a guy, his name is Dean Hecht, Michael Hecht. He's a YU guy, and learned by the Rav, Rabbi, he was in law school also. Dean Hecht is a good guy. So he came up after the Shabbos HaGadol drasha to Dr. Lander and said to Dr. Lander, I heard the Rav give shirim, and when I heard your son give shir now, I felt like I was hearing the Rav. You can't have more nachas than that. That someone who knows the Rav, you with me, and says to the father, I heard the Rav, and I heard your son, and I felt I was hearing the Rav again when I heard your son give shir just now. Now that's nachas. So I was happy that I heard that little conversation. That's Dr. Lander. Okay. And so when I was in, so I went under Rabbi Lanter when I was in Or Chaim. My brother was his Chavrusa for a while. Rabbi Tversky is Rabbi in YU. He's the Rav's grandson. Rabbi Tversky, you should know, very precise in his speaking, in his writings. If you want to find it, learn about the Rav, anything he says, anything he writes, he's in the family, very precise. The best article on the Rav, if you want to read one article on the Rav, 1993, tradition article, he wrote on his grandfather. It's the best introduction to who the Rav was. That's Rabbi Tversky. Okay. There are many more. Rav Ilson. Rav Ilson is considered the youngest of the Rav's greatest Talmidim. He was in their 70s. He was one of the Rav's top Talmidim, his top Talmid in the 70s. He opened the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael now, a very high-level yeshiva. They say that the Rav helped organize his engagement party in YU. That's a status, you know, that that the Rav himself did it, because the Rav was very, very fond of Rav Ilson. Rav Shurkin and Rav Meiserman are in Torah Smolch. Rav Meiserman is the Rav's nephew. These are tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. Rav Shurkin has written probably the best Sefer of the Rav's Torah, called Harvei Kedem. Harvei Kedem is a tremendous work. It's the Rav's Chidushim on the Moadim. Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, the whole thing. He writes it beautifully. Tremendous friend. That's Rav Shurkin and Rav Meiserman. There are many more. So that's the Rav. You can't overestimate the impact the Rav had on the entire Torah, whatever. We're not talking about the Rav now. That's a different shir that we gave, whatever. And so this is the dynasty from the beginning. And again, this is how, so when you think about it, we're not so far from the Gra. You have the Gra, the Pliny Belozhiner, a great, great grandson, six generations. Then the Rav is two generations later, that's eight generations. And then all of us here, our grand Talmidim of the Rav. Most Americans are the Rav's Talmidim. So basically, we can easily trace ourselves from here, this room, directly, 10 generations, directly back to the Gra. It's a powerful idea. That's the Masorah. A different year we discussed the Rav and the Masorah. But when you see it, when you see the whole picture, so hopefully it has an impact. This is the story. And so, of course, the punchline of all this is the idea of the Masorah. This is what life is all about, that all of us go back to our Rebbeim, and back up through the Rav, through Rav Chaim, back to the Gra. It's a very, very, very powerful idea. And we have to go through life making decisions, what will help keep me in the Masorah. This is what life is all about. So Vedic spoke about this all the time, and that was really the goal. The goal of this year is to give us this sense of who these people were and what our Masorah is. This is the Masorah in the non-Hasidish, non-Sephardi world. This is the Masorah in the yeshiva world, up back through the Gra. And this comes up in life so many times. A person's making a decision where to go to college, or a decision about, you know, staying in yeshiva, a decision about where to live, a decision about where to send one's children to school, a decision about who and whom to marry. All of these decisions end up connecting with, and they revolve, and they should connect with, and they should revolve around, how will this help me and my family remain a very strong part of the Masorah community, as Rabbi Soloveitchik used to explain. We discuss this on the Shir Barav Salveta, this idea of the Masorah, and that's what this Shir was all about, to get a sense of these people and see the connection, one generation back and back. Well, so that was really the purpose of this Shir, was to get an understanding of the fabulous, fabulous Masorah that we have, and to know and to internalize this. And we have to use this Masorah as the basis for the important decisions that we make in our lives. Will this help me remain in the Masorah, remain strong, my family, my community, my children, Bezus Hashem, or not? That is the crucial question one should be raising when they're making these important life decisions. Okay, we'll stop here. Okay, thanks for listening, guys.